Welcome everyone. For those who didn't have the course in personnel economics, the foundations of personnel economics in the winter semester, let me introduce myself. I'm Nick Zubanov, professor of organizational economics at University of Constance. I sit in room F249. So if you have questions, if you'd like to come see me, you're welcome to. So not that anyone bothers to come, by the way, but more on this later on. I will be teaching, among the other courses and seminars, I'll be teaching a course in personnel management. I like to call it personnel economics too, in a sense, so as to emphasize that the foundations of personnel economics in the winter semester and personnel management in the summer semester are connected. So I see a few familiar faces. Hands up who attended my Personnel Economics 1 course in the winter semester. I am impressed. Thank you very much for your custom. Given the... I should remind myself that I'm online to save on the repletives. So given the reception of this course in the winter semester, I really wasn't expecting anyone taking my Personnel Economics 1 course to be here again. But thanks for coming. Now, so this course is connected to Personnel 1, but it's different. It's different in two respects. First, it's more focused, and it's focused on the single issue. It's a big issue in HR management, but it's still a single issue. And this issue is, question is, how to motivate people. So whatever we'll be doing in the course, we will be trying to answer the question how to motivate people from different perspectives, different viewpoints, and we will be going through different ways of trying to motivate people. Most of them fail, some of them work sometimes. Now, the second difference between Personnel 2 and Personnel 1 is that Personnel 2 is a little bit more, technical. Yeah, so you need to use a bit of mathematics here and there, and you need to be good at microeconomics and statistics. So if you don't feel like doing mathematics, microeconomics, and statistics, a good time to drop this course while it's not too late. But for those who are reasonably comfortable with mathematics and microeconomics, when I was a student, I used to think that mathematics was the only subject worth studying. I've changed my mind since then. Now it's mathematics and personnel economics. So good luck to those attending this course. For those who will manage it, I think it's going to be fun in its nice and nerdy way. We will be going through a selected set of fundamental theoretical models in the literature describing different ways of motivating people. Here's a bird's eye view of the ways to motivate people and therefore the content of the personnel economics course in this semester. Yes?
I heard that in a different course you have loaded up like basic stuff to know from mathematics or statistics or so. Do you have it on this course?
Yeah, I do. It's here. Next slide. A bird's eye view of the course. Now, how do you motivate people? The simplest way to motivate people is to tell them what to do. Yeah? So, but it doesn't always work. There is a lecture which we're going to begin this lecture today, and next week there's going to be a continuation of the lecture on authority. So we'll have a lecture on authority in organizations, and this is one of the ways to motivate people to do things. Now, almost always doesn't work. When I tried to invite those guys to come sit closer, it didn't work. I didn't have enough authority. So I need to move on to provide some incentives, right? So provide incentives is the second way of motivating people, which works a lot more, a lot better, a lot more often. So, and we'll have a lot of lectures on various ways of providing incentives. And that's not a coincidence. It's not because I like incentives. It's not because my favorite topic is incentives. It is. but it's not because of this. It's largely because whenever you think economics, you think incentives. You can't do economics without doing incentives, right? Anything that we do in everything that we do in everything that resembles of economic activity, and not only economic activity, is essentially the result of various incentives that provoke people into certain types of behavior, desirable and otherwise. So we'll have lectures on monetary incentives, two lectures on monetary incentives actually. One is the lecture on linear incentives and bonus schemes. The second lecture is the lecture on the dark side of incentives, that incentives don't always work. Not that incentive, well, just don't always work. Nothing always works. But sometimes incentives actually result in the outcomes which are totally different, contrary to the ones that the designers of incentives intended. So two lectures on incentives. Then we will sort of tone down the incentives and say, okay, well, what can we do? Can we provide incentives in subtler ways so as to avoid negative consequences of people's behavior under incentives, under poorly designed incentives? It turns out, yes, we can. We can sort of provide incentives which are not so obvious, and not so easy not so easily susceptible to dysfunctional behavior. And in this regard, we're going to be looking at the issues of efficiency wages and career concerns. Heard anything about efficiency wages and career concerns? No? You've come to the right place then. So another way to motivate people when authority fails, incentives fail, is to say, come on guys, let's work. It's a sort of normal to work, right? So you can try to motivate people by having recourse to social performance norms, right? So, I can't incentivize you, I can't exercise authority over you. What I can do is I can say, well, come on, it's a sort of norm to behave in a certain way at work or in society. Now, it turns out that people are social animals, of course, and being social animals, people are susceptible. People's behavior is influenced by social norms, by awareness of the feelings of the others, and these influences can be exploited by wise decision makers to devise sort of quasi-incentives based on social norms. We'll have lectures on teams, peer effects, and feedback, which all belong to this heading, appeal to social norms. In these topics, we will look at environments in which incentives are not always present. In fact, things get a lot more interesting when monetary incentives are not present at all, right? And yet people do put not zero level of effort, being influenced by peer effects and feedback. And sometimes people even cooperate within teams, even when this cooperation is economically not worthwhile. Finally, we're going to be looking at another way, a fourth way of motivating people, which is to develop a principal-agent relationship. Everybody knows what the principal-agent framework is, right? If you seriously don't know what the principal-agent framework is, it's a good time to drop out of this course. Now, the classical principal-agent framework describes a situation which is based on the antagonism. It's a purely, in its essence, it's a purely antagonistic situation. So here's the principal who doesn't do work but derives profit from the activity of the others. And here's the agent who is hired by the principal to carry out a certain activity on the principal's behalf and receives a certain agreed reward from the principal. Now, the principal wants to maximize the profit, which is the difference between the outcome of the agent's labor and the agent's reward. And so the principal wants the agent to work as hard as possible and to pay the agent as little as possible, obviously. Here's the agent who doesn't care about the principal at all. The agent only cares about the difference between what he receives in the form of reward and the costs of effort that he's required to undertake in order to carry out the action that the principal has contracted with him. So the conflict of interest here is obvious. The principal hates the agent. The principal thinks that the agent is a shirker. The agent hates the principal because the agent thinks that the principal is the greedy capitalist exploitator of the working class and an offense to progressive humanity. There is a class of principal-agent relationships which are characterized by a lesser degree of antagonism. They're not fully harmonical, right? They're not fully harmonious, these relationships, because otherwise there would be no problem of incentives. There are still different incentives of the principal and the agent. But over time, it is possible to develop a relationship between the principal agent which features a thing called goodwill. Do you know what goodwill is? Goodwill? It's an accounting term. But I'm not going to be talking about accounting. Have you heard about goodwill in the sense of accounting? You can actually put it on your assets side. If you have a long-term productive collaboration with a certain supplier, so you get some preferential treatment from this supplier. For instance, you can get precisely the specifications you like within a shorter period of time than otherwise, and you get a discount that is not available to other customers. Now, the value, the economic value that you derive from this preferential treatment is goodwill. So here, goodwill between the principal and the agent is sort of unspoken, unwritten preferences, and unspoken, unwritten favors, if you like. Yes, favors that principals and agents offer to each other. Now, do they offer these favors, these preferential treatments to each other? Principal giving a bonus to the agent on a regular basis, or providing employment, additional employment security for the agent, or decorating agent's office in a way that the agent likes, and in exchange the agent works harder than he could have done in the absence of monitoring and authority. It's this kind of favors. Why are these favors exchanged? Well, it turns out that the principal, that over the course of time, the principal and agent form what's known as psychological contract. Have you heard of psychological contract? Probably yes, probably you have. From the evaluations of this course in the winter semester, I learned that that people actually know a lot more, but sometimes they're unsure, sometimes they just can't be bothered to speak publicly. So I'm sure you know what psychological contract is. We will have a lecture on psychological contract as part of this course, psychological contract, and we will also be talking about leadership in connection to a principal-agent relationship with some goodwill involved in it. Leadership is one of the one of the sort of intellectually interesting and provocative topics in modern management. Basically, the story is the following. When there is authority, the principal can command the agent to do certain things. It's like in the army. You know, the general gives orders to soldiers. The soldiers don't question these orders. When you have incentives, there is no authority as such. There is a contract. You are supposed to do certain actions, carry out certain actions which are verifiable under the terms of the contract, and you receive a certain, again, verifiable and quantifiable reward for carrying out these actions. If either of the sides falls foul of the contractual obligations, these obligations can be quickly enforced by court procedure or similar mechanism. So even though there's no authority, there's a contractual obligation to carry out a certain course of action for a certain reward. Now, in the case of leadership and psychological contract, there is no authority. A leader is not an authority. There's a difference between a leader and a dictator who has the authority. and there's no clearly written incentive contract. And yet people, for some reason, think that they should listen to the leader because there's goodwill involved in the relationship between the leader and the followers. So we'll be looking at these issues later on in this course. Let's move on and talk a little bit about course organization, administrative details, and the like. So I must apologize, it's completely escaped my attention that the ILIAS webpage for this course was not available for public view. I have changed it now, and so you could go to ILIAS, and download course materials from ILIAS page. Now, what are the course materials? Lecture slides, tutorials, and other materials uploaded to the course page. There's no textbook. There's no textbook. So all the course materials that you're going to need to pass the exam, you will find in ILIAS. I think it's good. So you don't have to buy any textbook or anything. Now, it's good, and yet I haven't said how many. I haven't said, you know, how many course materials there will be on the ILIAS page. I will go easy. I know that you have lots of other things to do. And so let's make this course intellectually interesting, fulfilling, and yet not too demanding in terms of the number of pages that you're going to have to read to pass the exam. Now, the course grade is 100% based on the written exam. There's no homework, there's no midterm, there's no course paper, nothing. I would actually like to have homework like I did in the winter semester. The conditions were people would get extra points. People did get extra points, those who produced solutions to their homework problems. An easier way to do so would be to upgrade the exam mark to the next step for the people who do homework on a regular basis. But I would need a lot more teaching assistance to help me with administering these schemes than I have in this semester, so there isn't a lot of time that I can spend on administering this course. That's why I reluctantly decided to scrap all these homeworks and midterms, and it's very easy, 100% final exam. It's a 90-minute test, much like you had in Personnel Economics 1 in the winter semester. Of course, the content will be different, reflecting the content of the personnel management course in the summer semester. Now, the course will consist of lectures and tutorials. The lectures will be held on Tuesdays each week here in this room between 5 o'clock and 6:30. There's one exception, which is the 6th of May. So on 6th of May, there'll be no lecture and no tutorial. The course dates you will find in the course schedule, in the introduction slides available on ILIAS. So as far as this course is concerned, ignore LSF. Imagine LSF does not exist. All right? So, yeah. Could I repeat the date? Why? Ah, 6th of June. I got it wrong. I don't need to repeat it because it's all written there. But yes, 6th of June, sorry, it was my slip of the tongue. I'm going to an important conference, the Econometric Society conference, couldn't decline the invitation. So no lecture on the 6th of June. Right. Now there will be tutorials. And the tutorial materials are now in preparation. Tutorials will be taught approximately once every two weeks by a teaching assistant. She's a master student. Her name is Henrike Biel. She will be teaching tutorials based on the materials that I will provide for tutorials. Now, pretty standard arrangement. I've been told in the student evaluations to try and link lectures and tutorials more closely. I'll try to link lectures and tutorials more closely. My idea of doing so would be to have two kinds of tutorials. First kind of tutorials is going through algebraic questions, going through exercises that you could do with pen and paper based on the topics of the lectures, right? So you take a model and you would solve this model for a certain constellation of parameters, then you change it, compare the results, and say some clever words as to the explanation behind the difference in the findings. That's one type of tutorial. The other type of tutorial that I've been thinking about is a tutorial in which you would go through an empirical study, a journal article published in one of the top journals in economics or management, where the issues that we discussed in lectures will be taken up and developed more deeply. So there will be two formats of tutorials. One is exercise-based, the other one is paper-based. What do you need to do well on the course? What do you need to have to do well on the course? That relates to Carolina's? Right. Question. Her question was, what do you need to know to do well on the course? Here's what you need to know to do well on the course. You need to have a good knowledge of microeconomics. Microeconomics, you know, utility function, profit maximization, first order condition, right? So that's what you need to have. You need to be good at maths. And by being good at maths, I don't mean being good at topology or linear algebra. By being good at maths, I mean being good at differentiation, integration, and optimization. So as long as you can take a derivative and take an integral and set up an optimization problem and derive first-order conditions and perform comparative statics on these first-order conditions, you're okay. So that's really not much to ask. It's a high school material of maths. There's nothing, you know, I'm not John Nash and we're not in Princeton, right? So the maths requirements for this course are not exorbitant. And you need to have a good knowledge of statistics / econometrics. So by statistics and econometrics, I mean not only knowing what mean and variance is, right? Everybody knows what mean and variance is. That's not enough for this course. You need to know how you run regressions and how you interpret regression output and what the main issues are with regression analysis, namely the issue of causality versus association. If you did a good course of econometrics in your bachelor studies, you'll probably fine. If not, don't despair. You can read about lots of things related to statistics and econometrics on Wikipedia. Wikipedia is really a cool source of information about mathematics and statistics, right? So next time, consider giving it €5 a year for the great services that this source provides to the learning community of the world. So that's as far as your intellectual baggage is concerned, which will be needed to do well on the course. One other thing that you could do to do well on the course is to participate in the course. It's almost a truism, right? Of course you have to participate in the course to do well on the course. What does it mean to participate in the course? Not only to be here physically present. As you can see, the lectures are video recorded. So if you can't come or don't feel like coming, or the weather is too bad, or the weather is too good, or the lecturer is asking too many questions, then, you know, as you can see, I don't run any sort of attendance list here, right? So you will hopefully get the video recordings of the lectures in the arranged for you in the right place, maybe even on YouTube. That's not an issue, physical presence. Of course, I would encourage you to be physically present here. What for? I really like lectures to be done in interactive mode. In the winter semester, I had bad evaluations from bachelor students for Personal Economics 1, and one of the most frequently occurring comments was that I ask too many questions and some students don't like it because they think that I'm picking on them. People apparently feel uncomfortable when I say, when I ask questions to particular people, you know, they think that I'm some kind of single them out. Okay, I will not be doing it, or I'll try not to do this. It's hard. It goes almost automatically because so far, until Constance, I was teaching at universities where this sort of interaction between student and lecturer was completely normal. But I'll try to restrain myself. I would still encourage people to participate by asking questions and making comments, or even maybe challenging what is being told in lectures. So it's much nicer for the lectures to be in the form of a dialogue rather than in the form of a monologue, right? So make sure that you fully participate in the course. Full participation in the course means asking questions and making comments. You learn a lot more when you try to ask questions, when you try to understand the course in greater detail than when you simply listen to the lecture. I am available to talk to students. I have regular office hours. I think they're on Thursday between 1 and 2, but you can just knock on my door, and if I have time, we'll talk. If I don't have time, we won't talk. You are encouraged to develop acquaintances while you're at university. You are encouraged to make friends with your fellow students, of course, to establish a good network, which will help you on the labor market later in your life. You're also encouraged to establish good relationships with professors. And the reason is very simple. I had people emailing me requests to write a reference letter on their behalf to, you know, as part of their application process for master program and stuff like this. So I had a few requests. I did provide reference letters, but these reference letters were very generic. Something like, this person attended my course, Personal Economics, and got the grade X. I've looked at this person's transcript and CV and finds their credentials worthy of being considered as an applicant for master program. Something like this. Very impersonal, you know. If only I knew these people, if only I had spoken to these people, then I would be in a better position to recommend. So a lot of you, if not all of you, will need references to go further with your master studies or with your employment. A lot of you may need Zeugnis, right? So a good way to get it is to make friends with professors. Okay, not only me, it's a general point, general advice for your studies. I think a lot of people are missing out on a great deal of their university experience by thinking that there is a yawning gap that can't be bridged between the students and the professor. So it's not true, and it makes sense to establish good relationships with professors, because these guys are going to may be helpful in writing reference letters that will propel you through the vagaries of labor market later on. Now, so these are the course organization details. Let's go through the course schedule. Forget the LSF. Forget the LSF. The dates and times and rooms are all here. If there are changes, you know, if I am ill, or if Henrique is ill, or if something changes, then these changes will be posted, of course. They will be communicated via Ilias. So make sure you register for this course via Ilias. I can't guarantee that you will hear the updates about the course if you go to LSF, because I don't operate LSF. I sort of operate Ilias, even though I don't know much about Ilias, but at least I can send a message to all the recipients on Ilias. So make sure you're there and you watch the course and tutorial dates and you arrange your commitments, your schedules accordingly. So today we're going to have the lecture on authority after these introductory slides. Next week it's the lecture on authority. I've decided to break it down into two lectures because it's a big topic and we don't have the full lecture today to talk about it. Now, 16th of May, we're going to have a lecture and tutorial. 16th of May, we're going to have a lecture and tutorial. There will be, of course, several tutorials because there are more of you than one tutorial group. So the schedule of for schedule of tutorials, please contact Henrique Bill for you know your tutorial groups, etc. She's running the tutorials. But there will be a tutorial on incentives and authority. There will be a few exercises on the topics of incentives and authority that Henrique will perform, and you will learn how to use these models. It's basically an advanced maths lesson, maybe not even so advanced maths lesson. Now, then on the 23rd of May, the next week, we'll learn about the darker side of monetary incentives. And in particular, we'll be looking at the topics of dysfunctional behavioral responses, when people do things that actually harm organizations rather than improve their performance, being influenced by incentives. I'm talking about, you know, I'm talking about sabotage. I'm talking about performing to the test rather than genuinely enhancing performance and improving customer satisfaction. And I'll be also talking about multitasking. Multitasking is a situation in which there are several activities that an employee is supposed to carry out, and these activities enter into incentive schemes. These activities have their own costs of carrying out. When you have several activities, it's very, very hard to design very sharp incentive schemes to prevent people from concentrating all their work on just one of the activities which is relatively better rewarded. Because obviously when they do so, other aspects of performance will suffer. Nobody wants this. Therefore, you need to make incentives less strong when it comes to one of the activities. A formal model of multitasking will be offered together with some anecdotal evidence behind it. Next week, we'll be talking about efficiency wage models. Efficiency wages is not incentives in the sense that you don't get more money if you work better. Efficiency wage is an incentive in the sense that if you're caught shirking, if you're caught not doing your work, then you're out. And once you're out, your next job will bring you less money than the current one. So it's not that you will gain money by working harder. The idea of efficiency wages is that you will lose money by not working hard enough. Okay, we'll have a lecture on this. Now, 6th of June, no lecture or tutorial. No lecture or tutorial. Highlight this day in red in your calendars. It's going to be a wonderful day. No personnel economics. Now, 13th of June, we're back. And it's a lecture on career concerns. What is career concerns about? There is a model. We'll go through this model. What is the intuition behind this model? The intuition behind this model is as follows. The performance outcome that you have created today will be taken into account by the labor market tomorrow to decide how productive you are and how much wage to offer to you. So the existence of performance history on the labor market will result in indirect incentives for people to work extremely hard in the beginning of their careers and progressively less hard towards the end of their careers. We'll be looking at exactly how it works in theory, again, some anecdotal evidence behind it, and then we'll have a tutorial on efficiency wages and career concerns. Then we'll say, okay, forget about monetary incentives. Monetary incentives corrupt people. They do wrong things. They shirk. They reduce their effort towards the end of their career, as the career concerns theory predicts. Let's try to rediscover the inner meaning of work and try to bring it up so that workers would carry out their job, not because they're paid for it, but because they genuinely like what they're doing. And somebody else will be making profits, because money, of course, doesn't smell. Now, this nice and idealistic approach to people management works In some situations, it has its severe limits, and we'll be looking at this problematic on the 20th of June. 27th of June, we'll have a lecture on performance evaluation. I didn't want to have this lecture. Okay, 27th of June, lecture on performance evaluation. Then on the same day, there will be a tutorial. 4th of July and 11th of July, we'll be looking at teams and peer effects. Again, we'll be looking at teams and peer effects with the purpose of discovering how appeal to social performance norms may positively affect people's effort. Tutorial. Then we'll have on the 18th and 25th of July, we'll have lectures on leadership and psychological contract. Leadership and psychological contract. And on 25th of July, there will be course revision. Yes? Yeah. So exam on the 21st of July, what it means is we're not going to have a lecture on performance evaluation. We're going to basically lift everything up. So 27th of June, teams. Oh. 27th of June, teams. 4th of July, peer effects. 11th of July, leadership. And 18th of July, psychological contract. Okay? Right? So let's lift the schedule one position up so that on the 18th of July we have a lecture on psychological contract. Okay. Right. Now, thanks for whatever questions you have about the course. Be aware that I'm hopeless when it comes to administration and organization, even though I'm a professor of organizational economics. There's a great deal of irony in the title of my position. So when you see that I am doing something organizationally wrong, please alert me to that. Now, we've roughly through to the middle of the lecture, and it's perfect time to start the first topic of this course, which is the topic of authority and employment relation. These lectures are on Ilias, so these slides you'll be able to download, and the video recordings are available, so it's okay if you don't have slides right now. So what is authority? Here's a quote from the Oxford English Dictionary, and it says a lot. It introduces to a lot of issues that we're going to discuss for the rest of this lecture. So, first of all, what is authority? Authority is the power to give orders. So, it's the legally, contractually recognized right or power to tell people what to do. Okay, so when I asked you to come join Closer, you refused, and quite rightly so. We had no authority contract between us, you know, we didn't write any contract according to which I would have the right to determine which place you're sitting, and you would listen to my order. On the other hand, imagine that I'm an invigilator and you've come to the exam. So I'm invigilating the exam, I'm the same person, you are the same persons. And then I would have the authority, I would have the legally recognized authority to direct you and have you seated precisely at the place that I will specify. Okay, so authority is a legally recognized right to give orders. So now it's a key element of employment relationship. You know, whatever employment relationship you look at, with maybe a few very curious exclusions, exceptions that you can think of in your spare time, in a typical employment relationship, there's always an element of authority. And why is it there? Well, could you have an economic relationship without authority? Could you have an economic relationship without authority? Anyone? Yeah?
Of course you can.
Like what?
Yeah. Like if the friends are working together, everybody makes his money, but they join together in their work. Nobody has the authority, all are on the same level.
Mm-hmm. So it's some kind of cooperative. Right, some kind of team, some kind of kibbutz. Right, you work on a field, grow bananas, then you sell bananas and share the proceeds.
But, I mean, even if you have a hierarchy,
yeah,
you don't need the authority if it's like everybody has enough money that he is satisfied with his job. You don't need the authority. You say
this hierarchy is going to be very unsustainable, because you know, let's face it, most people. To most people, money is never enough. So unless there are clear guidelines about who does what and who has authority over what, there are going to be conflicts. You know. So why? Let's look at cooperatives. Let's look at most famous cooperatives. So one of the most famous cooperative is the little English band called Queen. If you heard about it, Freddie Mercury, yeah, Brian May. Was well before your time, I realize, but it's a big thing in music. Eh? So it's a cooperative. The guys would come together, and so one would write music, the other one would write lyrics, and the third guy would do drums, and the fourth guy would do vocals. Okay, so and then they would share the proceeds, and then they got stuck, and pretty quickly they got stuck. Why? Because Freddie's music ideas were in conflict with Brian May's music ideas. And then if you don't have authority, whose concept is going to be implemented in the album? You know, I like high pitch, you like low pitch. I like bass, you like drum. How do we find a solution? We probably will not find a solution, so our cooperative is going to disintegrate. But you're right in the sense that it's possible to think about self-managed worker teams without clearly defined authority. But let's face it, most of the modern organizations do have hierarchy and authority and orders. Yeah? So back to my question, can you have an economic relationship without authority? Yes, you can. Sure, you can. I come to bakery and I buy a piece of bread. It's an economic relationship, right? So it's a relationship of economic exchange. I get my piece of bread, the baker gets my piece of money. Right? So there is no authority whatsoever because I don't have to buy this bread. I may or may not buy the bread. The baker has no authority to sell this bread to me. Right? It's my choice. Likewise, the baker is not obliged by any means to serve me. You know, there was a legal case in Northern Ireland when a bakery refused to make a wedding cake for a gay couple. They said, it contradicts to our spiritual beliefs. We're not going to make a wedding cake for a gay couple. Go and find another bakery. So in a lot of relationships, in a lot of economic relationships, there's no authority. In other words, you know, the parties to economic relationships are equally have equal amounts of authority, and no one gets to tell anyone what to do. And yet, employment relationship is a very special type of relationship in which there is authority. So, and by authority, we mean, again, the right or power to give orders. So there's a principal, the boss, here is the agent who works for the boss, and the boss gives orders to the agent about what to do. So the university is the boss, Nick is the agent, the university gives orders to Nick about how many hours to teach per week during the semester time. The university specifies the dates of the semester. The university specifies a lot of rules, provisions, and regulations within which Nick and other professors have to organize their activities, and that's okay. Because it's not a relationship of coercion, right? It's not that I am a slave or whatever. I submit to the relationship of authority on my free will. It's a willing relationship, meaning that both parties derive economic benefits from the relationship of authority as opposed to the relationship of no authority. So could university and Nick have worked together without authority? Sure. University, so I would go and establish my own GmbH, I would go and establish my own little firm, register it with the Chamber of Commerce, and then I would be selling my teaching and research services by the hour to the university, right? Then there would be no authority, there would be a contract, right? And yet, in most of the cases, the relationship between professors and universities, the relationship between employees and managers, the relationships between supervisors and supervisees are the relationships of authority rather than relationships of exchange. And the question is why? Why? This is the, this question has been thought through and analyzed by a number of really great thinkers in the history of economic thought. I don't know if you have heard about any of these guys. Any? Frank Knight, Ronald Coase, Coase theorem, transaction costs, why firms exist? Yeah. So Chester Barnard, Bengt Holmstrom, the guy who got Nobel Prize last year in economics. So Armen Alkayan and Harald Demsitz, great authorities on teams. So a lot of excellent brains thought about why some relationships are based on authority. And that's the topic of personnel economics, because personnel economics is about exercising authority over personnel, right? While some relationships are not based on authority and are pure exchange relationships between two independent economic agents. So here's some ideas. Some people thought, like Frank Knight, who has a famous, very influential theory about why firms exist, and he thinks that firms exist because some people are more risk-averse than others. And so if you're very risk-averse, you find it hard to face the great degree of uncertainty that independent economic activity brings about. So you would go and work for someone who would guarantee you a certain degree of income in exchange to the output that you will create for them. And it makes perfect sense if you are risk-averse. If you're not risk-averse, if you're risk-neutral or even risk-loving, you would not do that. You would set up your own firm and you would get the entire product of your output without paying anything to the other guy, and in exchange for facing a great deal of economic uncertainty that you don't care about because you are risk-neutral or even risk-loving. So authority exists because firms exist, and firms exist because people are risk-averse. Now, in firms, there is, of course, an agency issue. The workers don't want to work, and the bosses need to exercise authority over the workers to make them work. Now, here's Ronald Coase, the very famous, also Nobel Prize winner, who is the author of the so-called transaction costs economic theory. Transaction costs economic theory basically says that some economic activities, all economic activities have transaction costs, right? So if I want to go and buy a cup of coffee, I pay not only for the cup of coffee, I pay not only for the coffee, I also incur economic costs of walking to the coffee shop and spending time doing so. That's transaction costs. And some of the activities are cheaper to organize within firms and save on transaction costs, while other activities are cheaper to organize outside firms and thus face the full transaction costs. It depends. And so by implication, managerial authority entails lower transaction costs than independent relationship between two economic agents, and that's why authority exists. There were a couple of other ideas. You need to monitor teams, otherwise people will shirk, and authorities needed to enforce monitoring. Now, remember Holmstrom budget breaking rule from Personnel Economics 1. Teams don't work. There is lots of free riders. How do you ensure that people put in a Pareto efficient level of effort? You have the boss who distributes the output, and to distribute the output, boss needs authority. you need authority to ensure that people cooperate to each other, because cooperation means not only doing what's good for you, but also occasionally what's good for other guys, to make sure that people understand it and fulfill their promises. You need authority. That's according to Chester Barnard, who wasn't really an economist, who was actually an executive in a large American corporation. I forgot which. And now here comes Herbert Simon. Here comes Herbert Simon, also a Nobel Prize winner, a pure genius, a mathematician, an economist, a psychologist, a political scientist, you name it. One of the last polymaths of 20th century. And he's known in economics for his theory of authority. And the cornerstone of his theory was that authority is needed to maximize efficiency of decision-making under uncertainty. So, decision-making under uncertainty. Let's consider the problem of decision-making under uncertainty in Herbert Simon's setting and look with the help of some mathematical formalism at the benefits and costs of employment relationship versus market exchange relationship. Okay, so the paper, it's an old paper, it's more than 60 years old, still influential paper. A formal theory of the employment relationship. So, to understand this paper, it's a simple paper, right? But to understand it better, the mental scheme is as follows. You have to consider that there are two types of economic relationship. There are two ways in which economic relationship can be organized. One way is an exchange relationship, right? So, I need somebody's services to do some work for me. I can either hire this person as an employee, this will be an employment relationship, or I could buy these services from an independent contractor. I could outsource these activities to another firm, right? This is an exchange relationship. There are two types of relationship. And the question is, under what circumstances do firms prefer to have employment relationship and authority relationship? And under which circumstances economic agents, such as firms and workers, prefer to have exchange relationships without the element of authority. To understand it, consider a very, very simple, very stylized situation in which there is a worker, W, and there is a boss, B. So, worker, William, works for the boss, Ben. Now, Ben pays William a wage W in exchange for a certain action X that William does for Ben. Yeah. So, X can be a number, basically the number of hours worked, or, well, X doesn't have to be a number. X can be, you know, which attire do you wear on which day? Do you wear jeans or do you wear a business suit? X can be, you know, do you work and travel or do you work in the office? So all sorts of actions, both quantitative and non-quantitatively measured, can be within this action X. Okay, now, the boss and the worker derive benefits from their relationship, and they also pay some costs to set up this relationship. And the utilities of the boss and the worker are characterized by the so-called satisfaction functions. Now, these are really utility functions, but remember, it's 1951. The term utility function wasn't really a commonly accepted term there. So somebody called it satisfaction functions, others call it utility function, yet others called it target function. So it's basically a utility function. So what is the boss, what is Ben's satisfaction function, right? It's the function which positively depends on the output that the action X creates. So you just substitute different values of X into this function, F1, and it gives you different numbers. So different X's bring different outputs to the boss, okay? And the boss is paying a wage W to the worker, so the boss's utility is the outcome of the worker's action minus the worker's costs, which is wage. Now, here is the constant A1 which is really added for generality, I suggest that for the interest of time, we ignore it. So you just ignore this A1. Say it's 1. It's equal to 1. Now, the worker satisfaction function is the worker's satisfaction function is equal to the wage that he gets plus the function F2. Now, what is the function F2? The function F2 shows the worker's cost of effort. This F2 is negative. See here? It's negative. So the worker receives wages and he works for the wages that he receives, which reduces the worker's utility function. Now, how do we within this very, very simple setting, how do we define and look at authority? Well, the authority is defined as the worker does the action X that the boss selects. How can you enforce this? Very easily, you can write an agreement between the worker and the boss, according to which the boss will pay wage W to the worker for carrying out the action X. And this agreement is going to be viable, this agreement is going to be worth making when the under the values of X, specified values of X and W, the worker and the boss receive non-negative satisfaction. And if they don't reach an agreement, then no one gets anything and their satisfaction is equal to zero. So that's how it looks like. This is the range of values that X can take. For demonstrational purposes, X is assumed to be a number. So it's think about it as a sort of level of effort or the number of hours that the worker works. This is the this is the indifference curve of the worker's satisfaction function. The term indifference curve should be familiar to you from microeconomic theory. It's basically a set of points at which the value of the utility function for the worker is the same. So basically, all these combinations bring the same utility to the worker, and the worker will work if the combination of wage and X is anywhere here. So this is the viability, so-called viability region for the worker. Now, this is the indifference curve of the boss, and the boss will hire the worker only if the contract WX is somewhere here. And this region between the indifference curves of the worker and the boss is the so-called region of viability, region of mutual viability, within which contracts, so all these values of X and W are potentially efficient contracts between the worker and the boss. Okay, so far so good. And how do you come with the optimal contract? You maximize the sum of the satisfaction functions of the worker and the boss, and you come up with the value X that maximizes the satisfaction function, and then given X, you choose the W in such a way as to keep the worker on his participation constraint. What is the worker's participation constraint? It's the value of the worker's. It refers to the value of the worker's utility function such that this value is good enough for the worker to work for your firm rather than do something else. In this case, participation constraint has the worker's utility function being zero. So if your utility is zero plus a little bit, plus a cookie, you will work. If it's less than zero, you will not work. So having chosen X to maximize the sum of the surplus of the worker and the boss, the worker can then offer a W such, sorry, the boss can then offer a W such that the worker is happy with it. So very, very simple setting. To those who took Personal Economics 1 course, this should remind the very first lecture on incentives, when we say let's assume that effort is observed, let's assume we can contract on the level of effort. When we contract on the level of effort, we maximize the principal's profit, and we choose the wage, we choose the optimal level of effort of the worker, and then we choose the wage level W such that the worker will still work at this wage and exert the verifiable level of effort that, you know, pertains to efficiency maximization. So here is the same story. Now, Now let us imagine that things are uncertain. And things are uncertain in a sense, things are uncertain in the sense that the outcomes from action, from a certain action X are uncertain. So if I work 8 hours a day, I can produce 2,000 euros worth of output, or I can produce 2,500 euros worth of output. Nobody knows. Depends on how many people will come to my shop. Depends on how many deals I will end up making, right? So the difficulty is that the outcome is uncertain, whereas the contract needs to be made now and the wage needs to be agreed now. We're not yet in the world of incentives. Incentives are totally ignored here. So the only way to do labor contract here is to offer a certain fixed wage. Okay. Now, in this setting, there are two things you can do. There are two things you can do. One is to find an action X star that would maximize the expected value of the total surplus. So not the total surplus itself, but its expected value. And then find a wage W such that given the X star, the worker would still work and produce X star. This is called the sales contract. And the sales contract refers to the fact here that the worker sells his services to the boss for a fixed wage W. This is option one. What are the benefits and costs of this option? Well, there are benefits and costs, of course. The benefit is that this potentially is a way to find an efficient solution to the contract between the worker and the firm. The cost is, well, you write a contract, and this is crucial. You write a contract in which you specify one particular action that the worker is supposed to carry out. One particular action. So work 8 hours a day. But what if things change and the demand is high? So it would be profitable for the boss if the worker worked, let's say, 10 hours a day. The boss could try and persuade worker to work 10 hours a day, but the worker would say, sorry, here's the contract. In the contract, we say 8 hours a day. Or on the contrary, the day could be bad, demand could be very low, and the worker wouldn't be needed at work again. Or the worker would be needed on another day. The boss calls the worker and says, can you come? Not today, but tomorrow. The worker says, well, sorry, I can't because I have another engagement with another firm tomorrow. I can't. We've signed the contract, so I'm true to my contract. I will come today, and I don't really care whether it's good or bad for you. So this sales contract has a disadvantage, has a cost to the firm, to the boss, by offering very little flexibility of choice, which action the firm would want the worker to carry out. Now, here's the second option. The second option says, well, the boss and the worker sign a contract according to which the boss pays a fixed wage W to the worker, but now the worker agrees to carry out an action from a certain range of actions. So the worker agrees, the worker gives more flexibility to the boss. So instead of coming on a particular day and working for a particular number of hours, the contract says, I agree to come on any day between 1st and 30th, and I agree on that day, I agree to work any number of hours between 5 and 15, let's say. Okay, so you basically, instead of a certain value X star that maximizes the expected total surplus, we're talking about a range of values that the worker could potentially do, and the boss would then choose upon the realization of uncertainty, upon observing what's going on, the boss would then choose which value X from the predefined set big X he will want the worker to do. This is called the employment contract. And it's an employment contract, and this is the sort of example, a very simple example of an authority relationship. Why? Because the worker surrenders the choice of X to the authority of the boss, right? I no longer decide on which day I want to come, right? I no longer decide how many hours I want to work. I let these decisions be made by my boss in the interest of my boss rather than in my own interest. And this is the relationship of authority. Question is, which option is better, sales contract or employment contract? Not clear. Sometimes sales contract is better, and as a result, you have two independent firms transacting a business and engaging in economic exchange of goods and services, right? So, and under some circumstances, employment contract with the ensuing authority is actually an economically more efficient solution. So here's some intuition, and then we will put this intuition to a formal use to derive some theoretical results. So what's the intuition? When you have sales contract, the worker is sorted. The worker knows exactly which action he does and which how much money he gets for it. So he's facing absolutely no uncertainty at all, which is good for the worker. The boss faces lots of uncertainty, which is bad for the boss, right? Now, what does it mean in terms of bargaining? If you are not facing any uncertainty at all, then the risk premium that would normally be paid to you for facing this uncertainty is totally surrendered. Now, under employment contract, the boss gets a bit more flexibility and he can improve his utility by choosing exactly which action the worker has to carry out. So the boss gets more flexibility and so he can earn more money by choosing the best option for him. The worker can actually lose money by having to do an option which is not as attractive to the worker as he originally thought. Now, so there are gains and losses from employment contract and sales contract to both the worker and the firm. Now, the efficiency maximization, the Pareto efficient solution to this problem dictates that the choice of the contract, employment or sales contract, will be dictated by the maximization of the total utility. So let us compare the total utility, total expected utility from the sales contract and employment contract. We will compare these two total utilities and we will see under which circumstances the utility from the sales contract is higher than the utility from the employment contract. So here is a very simple case, in which we only have two options, A and B. So the worker can come on the first day of the month or on the 10th day of the month. Of course, in reality, such options are many more, but we need to really simplify maths here to get to the point of the logic. So two options. And the costs of effort for option A is alpha for the worker, and the costs of effort for option B for the worker is beta. So I really don't want to come on the first day of the month because of some other engagements. I would rather come on the second, on the 10th day of the month. So my costs of effort on differ between these options. Notice that in this example, the worker's outcome are certain. It's just numbers, alpha and beta. Both of them are negative. Now, for the firm, the outcomes are uncertain. So this is the outcome. This is the option A. The worker comes on the first day of the month. The demand is stochastic. Things are uncertain. The firm does not know exactly how much money it will earn when the worker comes on the first day of the month. So what you have here is the probability probability density function of the different outcomes that the boss can experience when the worker takes action A, and similarly for action B. So basically FA and FB are not numbers, they are random variables, and these random variables have a joint probability distribution. So this P of FA, FB is a joint probability distribution function of the outcomes under option A and option B. These outcomes may or may not be correlated. If they are not correlated, then you know you have a nice and symmetric probability density function. If they are correlated, then you have an elliptic probability density function. Under this setting, let's calculate the expected utility of the worker and the boss and the total expected utility from the employment and sales contract. Now, if they choose a sales contract, then they have to specify which option A or B the worker has to take now, right? So now there's uncertainty, the firm doesn't know which option is better, but they have to specify the option in the contract that the worker will take. Now, suppose that options A and B are such that for the firm, option A is better than option B. So if there is a sales contract, the firm says, okay, let's write down a sales contract according to which you will carry out option A and I will pay you a wage W. Okay? Now, if that's the case, then the expected utility from the sales contract is determined by this function. Let's look at the elements of it. Now, let's ignore this A1, A2. Let's set them to unity. It's not very important. So this is the random variable, the outcome to the firm from option A, times the joint probability density function of all the possible values that FA and FB can take. Right, and it's doubly integrated over the entire support of the outcomes from options A and B that can occur. So this is, if you like, the mathematical expectation of the benefit from action A to the boss. Why action A? Because even though you integrate over A and B, the mathematical expectation you calculate with respect to the random variable FA, which is the outcome from action A. What do you see here? Here you see alpha. Alpha is the costs of effort from taking option A that the worker is facing. So what do you see here? Here you see effectively the expected profit from option A under sales contract. Under employment contract, things are a little bit more interesting because under employment contract, the firm may choose tomorrow, the firm may choose which option the worker is to carry out, option A or option B. Now, if it turns out, when the uncertainty is resolved, when you see what demand is, right, you see exactly how many people are queuing in front of your shop, if it turns out that you would rather have the worker work on the first day of the month than on the 10th day of the month, so that the outcome from option A is better than the outcome from option B, the firm says, Nick, you have to come and work on the first day of the month. Doesn't matter whether Nick likes it or not. He's signed an employment contract with the firm, and the firm has the authority to tell Nick when to come to work. Okay? Now, what is the probability that the outcome from option A is greater than the outcome from option B? This probability can be very easily calculated knowing the joint probability distribution function of the outcomes from options A and option B. So what this expression says? It says option B can take any value whatsoever. The value of option B can take any value whatsoever between minus infinity and plus infinity. But the value from option A is such that it's always at least as high as the value of option B. So you have a double integral, all possible values from option B. And the second, the inner integral are all possible values from option A that satisfies the restriction that the option A is better than option B. So the value from option A has to be start from the value from option B and go up to infinity. And if you take this integral, this will give you the probability that outcome A is better than outcome B, and this is the event in which action A is chosen. Okay. Now, with probability 1 minus this, option B is better, in which case, if you have an employment contract, you will ask the worker to come on the 10th day of the month rather than on the first day of the month. Right? So, now, what is the expected value? What is the expected value of the total gain for the worker and the firm? It turns out that the expected value of the total gain under employment contract is equal to this nice little integral. And it's a good practice for you to remember your integration technique to try and derive this result. Okay, so try and derive this result as a preparation for this course. Now, let us compare the expected outcome under employment contract, which is this, with the expected outcome of the sales contract, which is this. Basically, take the difference between this integral and this integral. What do we get? This expression. What do we get is this expression. So, what do we see here? So, this is the difference between the expected gains under employment and sales contract. This is basically the integral of the expected gain to the firm, and this is the integral which defines the expected costs to the worker. The expected costs to the worker under employment contract, they of course differ, right? Because when it's more profitable for the firm to choose option A, the worker's cost of effort are alpha, but when it's better for the firm to choose option B, the worker's cost of effort are beta. In both cases can happen, both situations can occur under employment contract. That's why you have both beta and alpha in the costs of effort expression. Okay? Now, what is the sign of this difference? Suppose the sign of this difference is always positive. Right? What would that mean? If the difference between the total surplus from employment contract is always larger than the total surplus from the sales contract, if this difference is always positive, what does it mean? Should we always implement sales contract, or should we always implement employment contract? Yeah? Employment, exactly, because under employment contract the benefit will always be larger than under sales contract. Unfortunately, it's not always the case. So the sign of this difference in general is not defined. It depends on the circumstances. So let's look at this component. This is always positive. This integral is always positive. Why is this always positive? Look at the limits of integration here. The FB is always greater than FA, so that the difference between FB and FA over the limits of integration is always going to be non-negative. So this guy is positive, no problem. What about this guy? We don't know. We don't know because we don't know what the difference is between the costs of effort to the worker. If the costs of effort to the worker are the same, whether it's option A or option B, then this term goes to zero and employment relationship should always be preferred. Okay? So if it doesn't matter, for me whether to come on the first day of the month or 10th day of the month, if it doesn't matter for me whether to teach at 8 o'clock in the morning or 8 o'clock in the evening, if it doesn't matter, then the costs of effort are the same and this difference goes to zero, and so this component totally disappears and you have the remaining component which is unambiguously positive, and that means that the economy out there, the world out there, should look like lots of firms employing lots of workers and no self-employed independent agents transacting with each other. But that's of course not the case. You have lots of self-employed people, which means which means that if this term is sufficiently negative, the total, the difference between the total surplus from the employment relationship and sales contract is actually negative, so sales contract is better. Now, under what circumstances can this happen? It can happen under a group of circumstances. So, if you have not too sharp a conflict of interest between the boss and the worker, so there's not too much difference between the outcomes of actions A and B between the firm and the boss, then the difference is more likely to be positive. If there is a big conflict of interest, if, for instance, this is positive but this is hugely negative, then you don't know. Then if it costs the worker more to choose option B than to choose option A, even though option B is more attractive to the firm, then employment contract is not as profitable as the sales contract, because even though firms gain, the workers lose, and the loss of the worker is so high that firms cannot compensate it with the wages that it can realistically offer. Now, if there is sufficient uncertainty over the outcome for the boss, right? Why is it the case? Well, if there is sufficient uncertainty of the outcome for the boss, then this event, FB greater than FA, is more likely, and the value of this integral is larger. If the uncertainty of the outcome is very, very small, if the outcome is almost certain, the probability of this event happening is extremely small. So this integral, the positive part of this difference, is going to be extremely small, and the difference between employment relationship and sales contract boils down to the difference in the costs of effort from action B, between actions A and B carried out by the worker. So these are the two groups of reasons for choosing employment contract over sales contract. So once again, if the worker doesn't really care which action to carry out, whereas the firm really cares, really has a preference between action A and B, then it's more profitable for the firm to hire the worker and exercise employment relationship with this worker, exercise authority over the actions of this worker. If, however, there's a big conflict of interest between the preferences of the firm and of the worker, then a sales rather than employment contract may be more more viable. And second, there needs to be sufficient uncertainty of the outcomes for the boss to even consider having a choice of outcomes which is offered under employment contract. If things are certain, if outcomes are certain, then you can always contract the worker to carry out whatever action you prefer today for the price that the does not involve compensating the worker for the costs of effort and uncertainty. Now, we've come to the end of today's lecture. There are some observations on this model which I leave for your independent study. Last thing I have to say, the last thing I'd like to say, is that I found a suggestion made by students of Personnel Economics 1. I found it a very useful suggestion. And this suggestion was to give a few practice questions at the end of each lecture slides. I'm happily implementing it. So here are your practice questions and an additional practice question derive this result. And when you derive this result, derive this result to see how good you are at integrating things. So enjoy your Personnel Economics 2 course, and see some of you next week. All the best. Thank you.